Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favour to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Ruben Ward-Lindsay. Good evening, Ruben. How's it going, man?
I'm well, thank you, Yas. How are you?
I'm very well, man. I'm really looking forward to this one. I know it's been a few weeks in the making, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
So just talk to us, and before we get into the thick of the conversation, who is Ruben, what does he do, and we'll go from there.
So I'm currently a football coach. I coach at Watford Academy, doing their under-10s. I also have a full-time job where I'm a PE teacher at an alternative provision, and that's in Stopfold. And it's for children that have been, you know, kicked out of mainstream schools and have adverse childhood experiences, so it can be quite challenging, but I feel like that role always keeps me on my toes. And then recently, within the last like 5-6 months, I've also started coaching at Biggleswade United. So I started working with their men's first team, and that's been a really good learning experience as well. So it's been a good learning curve.
Awesome. There's a few different things to kind of touch on there. I think the first thing, let's talk about that day job. You know, you talked there about dealing with children who've had maybe challenging experiences and whatnot. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I guess one of the conversations I often have with a lot of colleagues of mine and peers is that you can straight away see the differences between the coaches who've had to work in those type of environments, whether it's in the same case as yours, or whether it's working in community settings or kind of community outreach and engagement projects. So go on, talk to me a little bit about that, in terms of what does that role look like for you on a day-to-day, and what are some of the transferable things that you've picked up that probably helped you in your coaching?
So in terms of the role, it would be teaching and delivering sessions for year 7s to year 11s. So we'd have 5 to 6 lessons per day. And then there's obviously a scheme of work that we'd follow, which is in line with the national curriculum. So it could be a variety of sports, badminton, basketball, football, for example. But one thing I found with that role is that because a lot of the children have additional needs, such as ADHD, for example, or quite severe autism, they can get bored quite quickly. So you have to be quite adaptable. You might have a basketball lesson planned and it might be the best lesson ever, but within 10 minutes, if they're like, I'm not doing this, then you have to very quickly adapt and, you know, fix things. In terms of the transferable skills, I feel like in terms of like coaches that work in it, not just in like alternative provisions, but schools in general, you can see the way they communicate with children is slightly different. They've got a better, I felt, understanding of when to change their tone, when to change their body language, maybe standing up, maybe crouching down to go closer to players. So I feel like working in a school has given me in particular a more holistic view of the way I communicate with children. And when you understand children's learning styles as well, that then impacts the way you coach. So you might be trying to coach and do stop and start coaching and children aren't taking it in or understanding it. But your player might be a visual learner, so they might have they might benefit from, you know, you pulling out a tactics board and showing them on the tactics board. Or it could be that they're a kinesthetic learner and they, you know, prefer more guided discovery kind of intervention style. So working with children has massively kind of impacted the way I deliver things and the way I approach session planning and delivery.
And just talk about it, because, you know, you mentioned obviously you're currently working at Watford. Talk to us a little bit about the age group you're working at and how you managed to get there. And I'm curious to kind of understand a little bit more about how the role, again, that same role that you've just been sharing there, has maybe impacted your coaching in either or, because as far as I'm aware, you're working in a slightly different phase, aren't you?
Yeah. So before, last season I was working as the under-14s lead at Cambridge. So it was very different in terms of managing behaviours and expectations, because players realise that the end goal is closer, and they're on the brink of that 2-year retain or release decision. So they're a bit more willing to take in information without you finding creative ways to deliver it. Whereas one thing I found this season with my under-10s is you can already tell, like within me working with the age group for 2-3 months, I can already tell there's a high level of additional need there. So a lot of our players, you know, do suffer from autism or ADHD. So even things like where I position myself when I'm doing a match day team talk, these are things that I've noticed as the season's gone on. There's been times where I've tried to do a team talk, but there's a game going on behind. So you're asking children with ADHD to focus on you, and there's a million things zipping around in the background. So even down to little details like that, I think, you know, working with this age group has really made me appreciate how transferable some of the skills are from my day job are into this role now. And it's been really, really transformational in terms of the way I view things.
I think that's brilliant as well, because obviously, you know, you talked there about just probably some of the things that maybe often as coaches we kind of overlook and just neglect to think about, right? Which is simple as where am I standing, where are you receiving the information from, what's around me, what's not around me. And it got me thinking about, like, even going back years ago, I remember when I did my level one and level two, little basic things that we were taught, and make sure the sun is facing your eyes, not the player's eyes and whatnot, right? And it's so many little simple things like that, right, which make a massive difference in terms of us get that information across, and also I guess checking on the understanding. One of the things you talked about it was obviously players in the academy at the moment might have additional needs. It's a real challenge sometimes, right? Because obviously a lot of parents probably struggle with the idea of actually sometimes accepting that additional needs are there, and I guess clarifying those. So do you often find that within your experiences where outside of the school environment that it's actually shared in a proactive way, or do you think that there is a bit of things that you might have observed based on your experiences which haven't yet been diagnosed or clarified for you guys, if that makes sense?
I still feel like there is a little bit of a stigma towards it, especially from young players and their parents. But I feel like it's become more socially acceptable in terms of recognizing and understanding when someone is suffering from additional needs. So I feel like the parents' perspective on it is evolving, and they're finding, you know, coping strategies and ways to help support their children. But I do feel like there is still a bit of a stigma. But what's quite interesting is that I obviously coach in men's football as well, and I can tell that they've also got traits that the children have as well. So you don't lose it when you get older. And it's interesting because, like, I would think when I go to coach men, for example, the way I would intervene and coach them would be different to the children. They're the exact same. If you don't intervene and say stuff within a minute, they switch off. So I feel like as a society, sometimes we neglect it and think, you know, when people grow into adulthood, they lose these tendencies, but they don't. It's still prevalent.
But it's interesting, right? Because I think at the heart of it, we often forget whether they've got additional needs or not. They're still players at the end of the day, right? They still want to play football, and they still want to just play football rather than be engaged by the coach and the stopping and starting, like you said. I guess, is that too simplistic to view it that way?
I think, regardless of it, additional needs at all.
That's my point, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, like, for me, the most enjoyment comes from when players have high ball rolling time and it's just individual stuff, because then they get to practice it. I think sometimes as coaches, we get manipulated too much by the stop and the start, especially when other coaches are watching us, more senior coaches, because we want to, you know, impress or show how much knowledge we've got. But actually, I feel like sometimes the players learn better by just letting them do it and, you know, us weaving in and out.
Awesome. Just let's come back to your journey. You know, you talked there about being in the academy in Watford, currently, previously at Cambridge. Talk to us about, you know, how did you get into coaching? What was that like for you? Why coaching?
So coaching was literally my first job ever. I just applied for a local coaching company on Indeed when I was 16. I literally just turned 16. Applied for a job at a local coaching company working with 18-month to 3-year-olds. And ever since then, it just kind of ignited my passion. So I'd done that for 7 years in total from 2016 to 2023. But it started off with the real young ones. And I feel like that also kind of molded me in the way I coach and the way I intervene and just communicate in general. Because I think if you can manage someone that's not even 2 yet, or, you know, someone that's really, really young, you'll be able to manage more senior players and older players and more advanced players. So that's where I started. Through that same company, I then started doing like their grassroots, like under 8s to under 12s program. So because I was the only coach that could drive at the time for that company, I was literally doing every single game back to back. So under 8s, 9s, 10s, 12s in the same day. And then I had a big say in terms of like what the training looked like, managing staff as well within that kind of club. So it was really good in terms of my development. And that's where I kind of first started. After leaving there, I then went to Luton. And I worked in like the community aspect. So I'd literally done everything at Luton. I worked in like their elite centres, their advanced centres. I led NCS for like 1 year when someone pulled out and they was meant to lead it. I stepped in and led that. And that was really good as well because I was working with teenagers and I was only like 21 or 22 at the time. So again, for me, it was really transformational in terms of my development. And then after Luton, I kind of got to a crossroads in 2023. So I saw coaches at the Trust progressing. And at the time, the relationship between the Trust and the academy, I don't feel was in a position where, you know, it was actively welcome for coaches to step in and observe. And I wouldn't say that was the academy's fault, but it was just, the pathway wasn't as clear as I thought it was. Mm. So I kind of made the decision to leave the Trust and go work full time in a school, in a primary school. And I was leading PE delivery there for a year. And then at the same time, I then saw application come up for MK Dons, and it was for a voluntary coach. And I kind of said to myself, I can either make a decent salary and, you know, continue doing what I'm doing, or I can take a step back, volunteer my hard-earned time in order to move forward. So that was my next kind of move, was to move to MK Dons and volunteer there. And then in turn, they helped me go on my UEFA B. So I was quite fortunate and it worked out in the end. And then after having left Dons, I spent a year there. And after having left Dons, I then went to Cambridge, done a year at Cambridge, and then obviously now Watford.
Mm. So it's got, you know, a few different transitions we've seen in recent years. I guess, you know, just coming back to your earlier point about the Trust and obviously the academy, and I think this is something that I speak to coaches a lot about, especially early on in their journeys, where they might say they're working for a club, but actually it is just the Trust. And I recently put a post out about this, you know, in that, is a phrase that, you know, I often share with a lot of coaches, which is those that know, right? And what I mean by that is number of coaches that will come and say, yeah, I work for such and such club, but actually it is just in the foundation and probably earlier on in their stage. And, you know, it seems like you picked it up, you know, at a certain point as well, that actually there's probably a very big misalignment between the community side of things and the actual quote-unquote academy side of things. And it's often the case that actually they just run completely separate entities, and it's just two separate organizations under the same banner, if you like. So I guess, you know, in recognizing that the pathway wasn't as close or as aligned as you maybe initially thought it might be, what are some of the biggest lessons that you think you've taken from that?
I think for young coaches, operating with humility is more important than ego. So as you said, everyone, you know, when they're younger, wants to say, I work for this club, and wants to boast and, you know, showcase how much knowledge they have. But you can't rush greatness and you can't rush the process. If you're not a good enough coach, people will find out and they'll know. So, you know, advertising yourself on social media is not necessarily the way forward. In terms of the things I learned making that jump, I would say, you know, having an open-minded perception on things and being willing to volunteer and put in the hard hours is something I recommend everyone should do, regardless of how senior you are. If you feel like it will accelerate your career and put you in a position that you want to be in, I would always recommend doing it. And the thing is, if you're genuinely passionate about what you do and you're bringing a high enough quality, other people around you will recognize that and then reward that. So again, that's why I was so thankful and, you know, I was provided the opportunity to get on my UEFA B in a time where I'd essentially passed my UEFA C like 4 or 5 months earlier. So from up until 2019, I had no badges. I got my UEFA, I got my level one, sorry, in 2019, got my UEFA C in 2023, and then got on my UEFA B and passed it a year later. And I feel like it was only through volunteering and, you know, sacrificing money and time that I was afforded that position. And I feel like that's something that not enough people are willing to do.
I couldn't agree more, Ruben. I think there's so much in that, right? And the fact that, first of all, you've got to do it because you're passionate about it. And I say to coaches all the time, if you're going to get into coaching and you want to make a career out of it, please don't think you're going to do it for the money. especially not at the start of your journey, because, you know, it's such a competitive industry, which makes it challenging for the market rate to go up in terms of what coaches can earn. And like you see so many stories now, right, where if a coach is wanting to really make money out of it, it's not down the professional pathway that they're going to look for. They might go and start their own business or whatever, right? And I guess something that, you know, is quite commendable in terms of what you've done, and I think is something that resonates with me quite a lot, is that piece around just taking time out, just sacrificing your time to volunteer and just learn your craft and develop your craft and, right, get around it. But also, you know, recognizing that, you know, you're in an opportunity where actually that might not be for everyone in terms of going from UEFA C to UEFA B within a matter of months. But the challenge for some coaches is they'll see someone like yourself who's done that and be like, right, that's everyone's journey, that's everyone's pathway. And actually, in reality, it's not. You know, you positioned yourself in a way where actually that became more of a possibility, even if that wasn't necessarily your intention. But also something really key in what you said was that you were just doing your thing and it was recognized not because you put it out there, but because someone else picked up on it, if that makes sense. And I think that bit's just really key. And it got me thinking about another experience I had recently where actually sometimes it's not even what we can say or what the person observes is saying. It's actually someone else is passing that message and, I guess, being your open reference or your public reference, do you know what I mean, without even you realising. So I think there's so many things in what you said then. It takes me back to one other quote. I think it was... Who was it? There was a player. So basically, one of my mates, he used to work in an academy, and I think it was Rio Ferdinand's son that he was coaching in the group. But he was working with this guy for, you know, working with his kid for the best part of four to 6 months, not even realizing it was Rio's son. And it was only, I think, at the back end of the season where he's like, oh, by the way, that's Rio's son. And it's like you now. That didn't necessarily lead to anything else, but the point I'm making is you never know who's watching.
Yeah, 100%.
And it is just sometimes, you know, I guess a lesson and a message for coaches to think about in terms of, are you always bringing your A game or are you just doing it when you feel like it? In terms of your journey, though, obviously moving from UEFA C to UEFA B in that kind of 6 month period or post finishing UEFA C, what was that like for you? Did you feel prepared for that? And how did you find going through that journey? Because, you know, someone who delivers on the B license myself, I think one of the biggest challenges for coaches going from the C, or even if it's not the C, going from the level two to the UEFA B, is that if you take today's climate as an example, we're in 2025, the old level two stopped running pre-COVID. So we're looking at 2019, 2020 at the latest.
Mm-hmm.
UEFA C's come out since then. So you've got a lot of coaches jumping on the UEFA B now, which in my opinion is probably a big jump from what the UEFA C is. But an equal jump, although probably slightly less of a jump, but probably just as much of a jump because of the time frame in between doing the level two and jumping on UEFA B, where level two is probably the last formal learning that any of the coaches have done. And you see it from day one as a coach developer that actually a lot of coaches are really, really struggling to get to grips with what the expectation of the course. What was that journey like for you?
I always felt like I was ready. But the only reason, or there was three reasons why I felt like that. The first one was I genuinely like internalized everything that my tutor said on the course and kind of, you know, thought about it with real depth and tried to action it within my own coaching. And whatever course you go on, if you're not actually taking in what the tutors are saying and try and actively apply it in your own environment, you're going to learn twice as slowly. It's just not going to work. By that point, I'd already been coaching for 6 years, effectively every day. So that was massive in terms of my development and actually spending time on the grass. And like I said earlier, people will be able to tell if you've spent time on the grass trying to work on different things and perfecting your craft or whether you've not. It was a big jump and there was still a lot of learning that I felt like was massively influential in the way I coach now on my UEFA B. And I think that's, you know, all down to my tutors. I had Paul Noddy Holder, And I had Jeff Noonan, and they were absolutely brilliant. And I think David Horseman as well came in on a few occasions, and they were absolutely brilliant. And some of the little golden nuggets I took from them were massive, and they're things I actively do today. And I feel like that's what coaching is how what you can take from other people and apply it within your own context, because no decisions or no ideas, I believe, in coaching are brand new anyways. It's very, very difficult to create an entirely new concept. So how can you kind of recycle other people's ideas, put your own spin on them, but then apply them within your own context as well? And that's things I think I done on my UEFA C and UEFA B. And that's why I think I developed between those courses, because I actually paid attention and tried to take it on board.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously, you know, you mentioned there about some of the coach developers on your course there. Now, those are probably not coach developers, will be accessible to every coach. Obviously, then the path that you've gone through has gone on probably what might have been an in-house pro game type of course, right? With those coach developers, I guess, what was that like for you? Because obviously going into that environment is probably going to be very different to what a lot of coaches go down in, quote unquote, the public route, if you like. Did that give you any raised expectations, or did you not actually think about that at all?
I was just fascinated by the simplicity of it all. So it seems stupid, but the way Jeff and Paul coached, it was so detailed but so simple at the same time. And it's like an art within itself. Players are still taking massive amounts of learning away from it, but there's no overcomplicated explaining, no overcomplicated rotations, nothing kind of outside of the box, but it's just the way they presented information and broke it down, which was so like influential to me. I can't even put it into words. Like, I felt like it's something you actually have to, when you see good coach developers, it's something you actually have to experience in order to understand. But yeah, I would just say there's so many things I could take from the course. Like for me, one thing I utilize a lot, which I learned from that course, is passive defending, like semi-opposition. So allowing players to be put into situations where they can see realistic pictures, but then they've still got success. And that's something that I didn't even consider before. Before, it was, for me, it was just unopposed, fully opposed, underload. So having that like understanding of passive defending and semi-opposition and chaos as well was really, really good in terms of my coaching, and there's things I've used from foundation phase all the way up to YDP.
100%. So just on that then, where do you sit in terms of that spectrum, in terms of where do you think the most development takes place? And again, I know there's an argument for every side of the spectrum or every part of the spectrum, but what does a Ruben Wood-Lindsay session look like on a typical basis if he's not constrained by a club philosophy or a way of playing?
For me, it escalates and it goes unopposed. So I'd spend the least amount of time on unopposed, but I still think there's value within unopposed stuff, because I know 15, 16-year-olds that are in academies that can't even open up and receive on both feet. So that unopposed repetition is still massively important, and it's got to be bilateral on both sides. And I feel like sometimes when we do technical practices, they're always right foot, or they always work one way. So having it both sides is massive. So I'd always start unopposed. Then I would go semi-opposed and kind of weave in defenders that will apply pressure, which is realistic to a game, so that these players can go, okay, here's how I use my unopposed technique in a scenario. Then I would go, for me personally, into like some sort of function. So a 4v3, 3v2, the same thing, but small numbers. And then from there, I'd go underload. So it's important that we don't lose sight of putting players in situations where they've got to escape 2v1s as well. Because I feel like sometimes we just go, all right, let's just add the plus one to the attacking team and make it easier. But if you want to develop really, really good players, you've got to make them, you know, put them in situations where they can beat multiple players and escape from multiple different scenarios. So yeah, for me, it goes unopposed, semi-opposed, function, where you're working on small numbers, and then anything underloaded or matched up numbers is brilliant. But I would always want to go underloaded to maximize that challenge.
And you obviously mentioned there, and I completely get where you're coming from, by the way. Two things, just for clarity. Just from your perspective, just explain what you think a function is, or what you understand a function to be, because there'll be people listening to this that got no idea what that is. And then second thing, you mentioned obviously unopposed, being the least utilized part of your session. Just elaborate a little bit more on that and why.
I would say there's value within it, but for me, the game is a team game. So in order for players to, you know, understand the game, they need to be in small-sided scenarios that replicate team play. I feel like those unopposed technical repetitions are important, but I call them the plus one. So are they things that you can actually do at home or in the park with your mates or with dad in the garden? If you can maximize your plus ones outside of the academy environment, then we can use our environment to put you under extreme pressure and, really test your decision making when it comes to having multiple different scenarios. I forgot what your second, what was your second question as well,
Yeah,
sorry?
just linked to the functions, because obviously this is a conversation I've had with a lot of coaches, especially as a coach developer and people's perceptions of things. And I'm just interested to get more specific, I guess, specifics on your definition of the functions.
So for me, a function is the thing that would come before. If you're going to do like a phase of play, a function would be before it. So it's effectively a phase of play, but like in half. So I would always look at small numbers. You have a maximum four players within it, for me personally, and it's position specific stuff or situation specific stuff. So if you're looking at build up, for example, if the ball's played to the right-sided centre back, you could have someone press down the line, someone curve the press inside. That right-sided centre back might then try to escape the pressure and play forward into mini goals.
And
So it's
just to
small
clarify
signals.
this, sorry, are you saying maximum four players in relation to the format of the game that you're currently working in?
If for me, like if I'm doing a function, it's like a 4v3. So more than not maximum four players on one team, for example, or with one objective. But you could have more potentially, but I would always keep it small numbers for me personally, because the phase of play for me then is what comes after the function. So it's the function, a small scenario-based activity. You then go into a more game realistic thing, like a phase of play, and then try and incorporate what you just worked in the function in the phase of play or in the small side of game.
Okay, so that's just regardless of the format that you're saying there. So if I'm working 9v9, 11v11, same concept.
Yeah, for me, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, no, because I guess for me, I would always look at a function as it being essentially an area of the pitch where you're, or it's going to be a portion of the pitch where you're either going to use just a central channel. Or just one other central channel plus a wide channel, so it will never be full width. But then again, your position based, practice based on players' positions, relation to the format of the game, and obviously the area sizes on that. So let's take that, because I'm gonna assume, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. This is obviously some concepts that you would have picked up and developed from your B license, to then bring into what you're doing now, possibly. Talk to me about your perspective on, I guess, the B license and how it then makes it relevant to the academy environment, especially if you're working at foundation phase. Because there'll be a lot of coaches thinking, oh yeah, but I'm never going to deliver this type of practice to the foundation phase players, or actually, I'm never going to go into that much detail with the foundation phase players, or more specifically, I don't even get that much space to work with my foundation phase players. Do you know what I mean? So where am I going to fit all this in, and how's it relevant? Go on, I don't know what your thoughts are on.
So, in regards to space, one thing I learned on my C license course, not even on the B license, was can you maximize your use of space by setting up like overlaying practices over each other? So, I feel like if you're clever, you can design any session within a quarter of a pitch, as long as you're setting things up to flow between practices. In terms of like the transferability on the B license, I think even in the foundation phase, or especially in the foundation phase, actually players are sponges. And they know a lot more information than you actually would think they know. So, for example, today, like I remember we were speaking about defensive principles. I just asked the boys that under 10s, when the ball goes wide, what does your body shape look like? It looks wide, so you can use the touchline as another defender, is what one of the under 10s said. And for me, that's a great bit of information and knowledge that he's been able to bring about. So, the things you learn on the B license, whether it's individual tactics or how to work with units, I think it's all transferable into regardless of what numbers you use, small numbers, big numbers, it's all transferable. And the level of detail isn't a bad thing. You want to effectively create good learners, and if players are good learners, then they can, be able to take in a good level of detail and retain it. And it just depends on how you communicate what you're trying to communicate in order to see how they learn, basically, or in order to see how they retain that information.
It's really interesting, because obviously you're saying about speaking to those players there, and them essentially knowing more than what you think they would know. When did that start to become a thought for you? Because I think that's I completely agree, by the way. I think we don't give players enough credit sometimes, and I think sometimes the challenge comes, especially early on in our journeys as coaches, is that
it might become a bit of an ego thing and a control thing where actually I'm the coach, I should be telling you what to do and what not to do and what should be right and wrong. But actually, the players have some good answers. The players know what they're playing. They're playing the game of football constantly. So like they know what they're doing. They just maybe can't always articulate it in a way that we might as coaches, right?
Mm-hmm. I would say I've noticed it more so this season than anything. So, you know, throughout my coaching journey, I've used intervention methods like question and answering quite frequently because I think it goes hand in hand with teaching. And let's say I was coaching at MK Dons in 2023, I'd ask a question the players would answer. So in terms of like checking their understanding, you're like, yeah, they understand, brilliant. Now that I've started working at Watford with this specific age group, it's like I can't even finish what I'm saying. And their hands are already up and they know the answer. And I feel like it's because they've got that genuine passion and excitement for learning. So, and this is the youngest age group I've worked in academy football. Like when I was at MK Dons, I was primarily with the 11s and 12s. Obviously, I dipped in and out the foundation phase, but I was predominantly with the 11s and 12s. So I feel like working with a young group and a group that are so passionate to learn has really shocked me because, and the thing is as well, like there's times where they're not even looking at you and you feel like they're not paying attention. And then you're checking their knowledge at the end of the session and they know the answer. And I just think it's because they genuinely love football.
See, it's quite interesting that because I think even just looking at the engagement of the players, right? Like you mentioned there about the players are looking and they might even be looking at you, but they just don't know the answers. And it's interesting because I am actually someone who, if I was a player, I don't think I would look at the coach. I'd be off with the fairies, but I'd be processing everything that's going on, right? And it took me a few years to even realize that about myself to the point where I was like, I'm not really bothered whether the players looking at me or not, especially in the foundation. And I think one thing that clearly comes out in what you're saying is that about the players being passionate. Is it that they're passionate or you've created an environment where passion becomes the thing? And it's sometimes I say to coach all the time, like the players will be engaged by whatever you give them. Right. But if they don't see the relevance of it, it's going to switch them off. So if they can understand that, whatever it is, you might say point A, B, C. Point A, B, C is relevant to me because I understand what you're talking about. If I don't understand why it's relevant, I'm not even going to consider it, right? And I guess it doesn't matter what age you are, what stage you are, in my opinion, but I think the players need to understand the relevance of what you're saying and not just be able to understand what you're saying, if that makes sense. And I guess within that, it also then kind of leads into the fact that if they don't understand the relevance of it, they're going to switch off. So I say it all the time that for me, relevance drives engagement. If I don't know why I'm doing something, I'm not going to do it. Now, some people will then turn around and say, well, that person is a difficult person or a difficult player because they're just not taking on board instructions. Well, no, maybe the coach, and it's interesting, I want to get your views on this, is that maybe the coach sometimes needs to do a little bit more in terms of making sure the players understand why they're saying what they're saying rather than, I'm the coach, here's my instruction, off you go.
I feel like as coaches, we need to do massive amounts of introspection. And if you don't do that, then you'll be doing a disservice to the players. So one thing that I've tried to incorporate this season is because I'm so passionate and infectious about it. And obviously, you know, Levent, who's my colleague, he's so passionate and infectious about it. We can be quite, not noisy on the touchline, but we like to be in the game. We like to give information. We like to coach players. Sometimes I'm like to Levent, let's just be quiet this period and not say nothing and allow the players an opportunity to manage momentum and figure things out for themselves. And I feel like that's when you really, really are able to step back and actually observe things and check their understanding of what you've been working on. Because we always link, we have two in possession, two out of possession focuses generally when we're coaching on a match day. And we always link them to what you've worked on throughout the week. So if we've been working on crossing, we'll have a look at, for example, creating a variety of crosses. So like cutbacks, lofted, low and hard across the box. And then the second in possession focus might be on double movements to then receive the cross and finish. When you actually take those moments to step back and say nothing, that's when you're able to then actually identify and recognize if these things are occurring or not. Because if you're constantly talking and trying to process things and engage players and talk to players, you don't have time to actually step back and observe. And going from like a cat three to a cat two, where I've had, you know, where I've been the essentially at times the only coach to now having another coach to work with, it's even more beneficial because if Levent's loud, I might not talk. If I'm loud, Levent might not talk. And you pick up on things that you necessarily wouldn't pick up on yourself. So it's been massive.
This is a really interesting point, though, right? Because, you know, I say to coaches all the time, one of the best skills you can learn as a coach, especially if you want to progress and become, I guess, a coach at the quote-unquote elite level, is how to co-coach. I think co-coaching is so underrated. It's so disregarded as an effective skill to have, in the fact that often what happens is, you know, when you see two coaches working together, it's like me and you working together, right? Ruben, you're going to do your part. When you're finished, I'm going to do my part. Actually, no, it's how do we work in collaboration, in tandem, as things are going on. And, you know, even within the co-coaching relationship, whether that's in an organization that provides a framework, which is both coaches are on the same level, or we've got a lead and assistant, like managing that dynamic. And, you know, it doesn't always necessarily have to be the lead coach, so to speak, that's actually running the session. Sometimes it could be the assistant coach running the session and the lead coach is doing the bits in between it, right? You know, just talk to me a little bit about that. Obviously, you talk there about you moving from Cambridge, where you're predominantly, you know, working alone almost, to now obviously working with someone. What has been the biggest changes for you, and what are the biggest things that you're finding challenging within that process?
For me, sometimes it's just stepping back, and I'm quite conscious of my own behaviours and mannerisms. And because I'm someone that naturally wants to lead and wants to help others and give advice, sometimes I've found myself not overstepping the boundary, but being conscious of, I don't want to annoy my co-coach, because at Watford, we don't have a lead and an assistant. We're both on the same level. So I also need to offer him ample opportunities to be able to not only develop himself, but develop the players, have opportunities to lead, have opportunities to assist. And I feel like that's something we've got. We've managed to strike quite a nice balance in terms of speaking to each other quite a lot and saying, this might be my role today, this might be your role today, and how can we have, you know, assimilation between our roles? Sometimes, like you said, when you have one person leading parts of the session and then another person leading parts of the session, it can often feel quite disjointed, because I might design a ball mastery session that doesn't link at all to your possession session, and it's just confusing the players and giving them mixed messages. So I think that clarity and working alongside each other is important when it comes to session design, but then also how you delegate. So, you know, we've gone between him leading parts of the session, me leading parts of the session, to then Tuesday might be his day to coach and Thursday is my day to coach. And then I assist on a Tuesday, he assists me on Thursday. And we try to manipulate it. So we're having ample opportunities to essentially do everything, see every player, coach every player, and have different experiences, because at the end of the day, it's not just the players developing, it's us as well, as coaches and as people. So if we're not given fair opportunities to develop, it's not going to put us on the same pedestal. So I think it's really important.
No, I think it's a brilliant point. I guess I'm curious to kind of find out then, you know, what are those conversations actually like between the two of you, and, you know, and if you were even to work with another coach, like what are the things that are kind of on the top of your list to say, right, these are the points that need to be discussed when I'm going into this relationship with this coach, because ultimately, there is ego involved, no matter how little, how big it is. And I think that just comes with the territory of being a coach, and especially in this type of environment, right? So there will be that piece. There will be the piece of what I want to offer some value. I want to add something too. But then, like you said, you don't want to step on the toes of someone else and stop them from having an opportunity. But something really important in what you said there as well, and I want to pick up on, is you're also developing as a coach. So how do you strike that balance? You know, what are the conversations like? How much emphasis do you put on, actually, this is something I want to try versus what do you want to do? But also recognizing that within that process, ultimately, the end user is still the player, right?
I think the first thing is having an understanding that you're not going to win every battle. So you might push for certain things, but at some point you have to, you're reasonable. The reasonable aspect of your personality needs to come through and actually allow the other person to have the same things as well. So you're not going to win. There's no point sitting there arguing about things. Oh, we should do a technical. No, we should do a passing and receiving. No, we should do a ball mastery. It doesn't matter in the long run, I think. As long as the players are getting a higher level of coaching, I think there's wiggle room in terms of what you want to deliver and what someone else wants to deliver. One thing I always do is if I'm speaking to my colleague, let's say, for example, you know, I message him first about the session next week. I'll present a plan and an idea and say, are you okay with that? Do you want to change anything? And then that opens up a discussion. And I think it's important that we have these difficult conversations and challenge each other, because then if we don't, no one grows. And being receptive to other people's opinion is massively important as well, because I've worked with coaches that I think are far better than me, and they've asked me my opinion, And there's coaches that I've worked with that I think are far worse than me, and I still ask them for their opinion. So
just on that, though, that's a really good point, Ruben. If you do get asked, you know, by a more senior coach, your opinion, how does that make you feel?
I think it's massive. Like, it's the ultimate sign of a compliment, really. And I think it indicates positive personality traits and a humility to actually go, I don't know everything. Because sometimes as coaches, like I said, especially when you're a young coach, like, you feel like you've got to prove yourself to the world. But actually, some of the best ideas I've ever got in coaching have been from people that might be interns or volunteers, or, you know, are low down on the coaching or social pecking. But they've given me some of my greatest ideas ever.
I think it's really interesting. It's a really good point as well, because I remember speaking to a coach recently, right? I've taken it for granted, but being a coach developer, obviously I'm working with coaches all the time, and, you know, on paper I'm more experienced than the coaches I work with, right? But I actually agree with you completely. Like, you know, I learned shitloads from the coaches that I'm supposedly working with and trying to aim to develop, right? Because actually, more often than not, they come up with some brilliant ideas, but maybe they just don't have enough knowledge just yet to piece the bits together and connect the dots, which is where obviously the more experienced, the experience kind of comes in handy. But I guess linked to that as well is recognizing that, and I say this to coach all the time, like, you can't do everything. Like, there's going to be things that you've got which are blind spots and areas for development, but equally there's going to be things that you're brilliant at. And it goes back to the earlier point, right, about, you know, having those transferable skills from your day job. I say to people all the time, like, you don't need to be good at everything. You don't need to be, you know, you're not going to be bad at everything either, but if you can just find one or two things that you're really good at. And a really important part to understand is, well, you don't need to be the best at it. It's just what you're good at, right? Because, you know, as an example, let's just say you're good at, I don't know, session planning. Okay, brilliant. But that might be your strength, designing a session, putting a practice together. But that might also be Jose Mourinho's strength. Now, I'm not expecting you to necessarily be better than Jose Mourinho at doing it, but you both got the same strength at different levels, if that makes sense. So it's okay to not be the best, but recognize what you still is your strongest attributes, if that makes sense. And I think that bit's really key. But then obviously, managing that piece around working with another coach and recognizing that actually, again, neither one of you is going to be the finished article. So what are you bringing to the table? What is that coach bringing to the table? How do we bring all that together? And I think something else that's really, really important to touch on, what you kind of touched on as well, is that having that conversation beforehand, and you might have an opinion, he might have an opinion, but ultimately, it's not about what opinions you have, it's about what we agree on. What are we, you know, even if it is a case of like me and you working together and you say, oh, yes, I've got this idea, is there anything you want to change? Yeah, I might do it this way. By the end of that conversation, we still need to agree on what direction we're going in. So I can have my opinion on it. You can have your opinion on it. But those opinions don't mean anything until we've agreed on what we're doing. And that's the only time in which you kind of, you know, apply, reinforce, and I guess review in terms of whether it's been effective or ineffective. But on that, I'm curious, not just because I know the coach you are working with currently, but just in general, in past experiences, has there ever been a time where you've maybe not been on board with the ideas of another coach and think like, oh shit, actually maybe there's something more to this than I initially thought, or it's shifted your mindset in any way?
100%. And sometimes it's frustrating, because if you feel like someone's delivering something or putting on something that isn't of a standard that you would want to associate yourself with, you kind of disagree with it and it doesn't feel right internally. But again, I think it comes back to my last point, that sometimes you're not going to win every battle, and sometimes you might just have to let go and allow people to learn things themselves and experience things themselves. And I'm sure that I've worked with coaches that I've not put on my best session and they've gone, didn't really enjoy that. But the fact that they gave me that opportunity to do that was massive in terms of my learning and my journey. So I feel like you can't, like I said, you can't always approach everything with an ego, and you actually have to allow people to make mistakes sometimes and do things that you disagree with in order for you to then have that review process to go, all right, that idea might not have worked. Here's why it might not have worked, but we're going to learn and we're going to grow from it together, because you're still united by that same badge at the end of the day. So if you have disagreements with people, it doesn't necessarily matter in the long run. You're trying to serve the end purpose, which is providing the best for the club you work for.
100%. So I guess, linked to the question, what have been some moments where your mind has been changed by some of the things that you've seen, or actually you went into something with a firm belief that this is how I'm going to do it, this is the right way to do it. But then someone else has come across or something, or you've observed something else, you reflect on it, that actually maybe I didn't have the best way, or actually tell me more about how you did that.
I would say on a few occasions, I coach futsal for a company called Street Futsal Club in Luton. It's run by Ross O'Kane, who was like the foundation phase lead at Luton for like 10 years, and then he went to Chelsea, but he's a really, really experienced coach. And there's been times where I've worked for his company where, you know, we've got futsal league, so we're playing other academies. And I'm quite adamant that when I play futsal, I want to play in a box, because for me, it's just the easiest formation to understand in terms of rotations off the ball, pressure off the ball, and having a good amount of pressure and cover in the middle. So for me, like, blocking that middle pass is massive. But then there's been times where we've played other academies, or other teams rather, they've played a diamond, they've played a 2-1-1, they've played a 1 and a 3. And it kind of opened my mind in terms of not being too adamant in terms of what I want from my team. Again, at Cambridge, like, we were really, really strong in a 4-2-2 diamond. So we played 4-2-2 diamond. And we've done that quite often. But in hindsight, I felt like there was opportunities for us to play different formations or experiment during certain games to give players a holistic understanding of the game. And sometimes I felt like in the past I might have compromised winning that game to prove to people higher up that I can do my job correctly, rather than giving players valuable learning experiences. Because let's say, for example, in the YDP at Cambridge, if a player gets loaned out to a non-league club and they play a 3-5-2 and he's never had an understanding of combining off long balls in behind or second balls or hooking the ball over his head, I've done a disservice as a coach. So I would say coming up against stronger formations that have been able to break down my formation and me not being willing enough to adapt quick enough was massive in terms of my learning. And it's happened quite often in the past.
I think it's that recognition, that willingness to accept that, you know what, I don't have all the answers. Right. And it reminds me actually, because, you know, many years ago, me and Lev used to work together as well. And I used to get so frustrated working with him. Used to get so frustrated. We worked really well together, right? We were very, very different. And I think the bit that really helped is that we both saw the game in a very similar way, but we had a very different approach in terms of how we would do it, in terms of how to actually coach it. And it used to frustrate me at the time. Yeah? And it was only later years on that I've learned to appreciate it. And it was, we'd be observing something and he would pick up on it a lot quicker than me. He used to piss me off, man. It's to piss me off, but the thing is, it wasn't because I couldn't see what he was seeing. He would see it quicker, but it was only kind of after a bit of time where I realized, you know what, actually I've got to put it into context. He's 10 years older than me, but he's also been coaching the game for 10 years longer. He's just been doing it for longer. And it's not just doing it for longer because of time, it's the volume of consistency that he's had doing it, right? And this applies to all coaches, right? It's not, you know, I think it's not about how many years you've been doing it, it's how frequent you've been doing it within those years, I think, which makes the difference. And I talk about it a lot in that, like, funnily enough, back in 2017, I was actually working at Watford myself. And, like, I had, like, an 18-month period where I was probably coaching about 25 to 30 hours a week on the grass. Like, just, I'm working across 4 or 5 different types of groups, working in the academy, working at university, working at college, working a couple of different environments on top of that. And I'm just literally just churning the sessions out. But I was in a zone where I was just constantly reflecting, refining, developing and whatnot. And it was the most accelerated part of my coaching journey, hands down. But I think it wasn't just because, like I said, that was an 18-month period. By that time, I'd already been coaching for about 7-8 years. So it was like something changed within that process. And the difference was, is that during that time in particular, not only was I working more intentionally, more frequently, but I was also around more intentional coaches who were also doing things frequently, which meant the coaching conversations I was having and the reflective conversations I was having around my practice, around their practice, around everything around development of coaching, was just more impactful. In it.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
This is Michael Rosenbaum. Hey folks, let me tell you that drinking and driving is a decision that will change your whole world. Things will never be the same once you get a DUI, because legal fees and time in court are just the beginning. Getting into a crash is another way your world could be irreversibly changed after drinking and driving. Your vehicle may not be the only thing that gets damaged in that crash. You could face a life-altering injury or even death. But you're not the only one who could face those consequences. Your decision to drink and drive could permanently change someone else's world, whether you injure them or leave their loved ones grieving. The next time you're out drinking, call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or a designated sober driver. Always plan for a safe ride home. The only decision that will change your world for the better is the decision to call for a sober ride. It's never worth it to drive drunk. Don't risk it. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
Intentional and deliberate, right? So I guess to take that towards you now, like what's been the biggest shift for you? Like, what's been the biggest reflection for you in terms of, actually, this really works for me within my development? This has really helped me because... just to give some context, I'm currently doing my doctorate, and I don't know whether I'll ever get there, but I'm trying to figure out what works in coaching and coach development. So I'm curious to know from your own experiences, what's worked for you in your coach development?
For me, the time I was at Cambridge was the quickest I've ever accelerated in coaching. I would say the jump from C to B, you learn so much on that course, but nothing could replace coaching, leading a session 3 times a week by yourself on a quarter of an 11-a-side Astro with sometimes 16, 14-year-old players. For me, that was the most difficult spell in my like whole coaching journey, because I had to be very intentional about where I made players stand in practices, the transition between players coming in and coming out of practices, because you can't have 16 players playing on that tiny space at once. So I had to be very clever in terms of how I manipulated sessions to still get nice flow, but then also make sure players were still getting outcomes linked to their ILPs. As well, like Cambridge provided me a lot of autonomy. So the 13s lead would coach. I would coach as the 14s lead at the time. The 15s lead would coach. Faye's lead would often be coaching as well. And he would predominantly work with the 15s or 16s, because obviously that's a slightly more competitive age group. Obviously the 14s have their 2-year retain or release decision, so he was, you know, dropping in and out and working frequently with me as well, but he predominantly spent most of the time with the 15s and 16s. So for me, it was like, I'm in the deep end. This session has to flow. I'm responsible for everything. All these parents are like 2 yards away from me. It has to be good, and I've got to present myself and account myself in a good way. So I was very, very conscious of what was coming out of my mouth, the way I would design sessions, the way I would coach, and just how much I put into that role. I felt personally, in terms of making sure I was going above and beyond to help the players within the phase. Within that as well, I feel like sometimes when, you know, you have people in positions of power and when they watch your coaching sessions, there might be all the hoorah around that session wasn't good enough, I didn't appreciate, didn't like this, didn't like that. But I think sometimes when you're a coach, especially if you've been coaching for long enough, you know if your session's not good enough or not. So in terms of having a lot of autonomy, because I was by myself a lot, didn't always have those eyes on me. So I would drive back from the sessions reflecting, going, that was not a good session. And it was only because I had those opportunities where I was by myself, I had to effectively hold myself accountable and blame myself for everything.
Do you know what? It's just really interesting in what you said there, right? And there's a couple of things. First and foremost, it's the importance of being deliberate and intentional in all your actions, right? And not just in your actions, but your reflection of your actions. Secondly, you said something there which really resonated with me, and it's take the blame. You took the blame, right? And I say to, again, funnily enough, like during that period I just shared a few moments ago around that I thought was most accelerated for me, one thing I constantly did and intentionally did and frequently did was I used to tell myself, right, even though it's not my fault, it's my fault. So what am I going to do about it? Because he used to put me in a frame of mind of almost, right, okay, if we're being realistic about the situation, I might not have had any control over that. But could I have done something to influence it? As in, players rocked up, they're in a bad mood or whatever, as an example, or that hasn't been quite right. Okay, it's got nothing to do with me, but how can I make it so that it has got something to do with me, if that makes sense, right? Because then you start to take control over everything that's happening, right? And the things that you haven't got control over, they're just going to happen anyway, whether you like it or not. But there is other things in the environment that you certainly can influence. Like if a player rocks up and he's in a bad mood or a player's not on it today, actually, I could probably make those adaptations which you referenced earlier to the session to make it more appealing for them. I could probably, I recognize the players have rocked up today. They're still tired from the weekend's game. It's a Monday night session or it's a Tuesday night session. They've been at school Monday, Tuesday doing exams or whatever. Mentally, they're beat already. Cool, let's just take off the gas a little bit and just, you know, lighten up the load in the terms of the session. Doesn't have to be as intense as it might have been initially in the plan. And it goes back to the earlier point you made earlier, right? Around the planning. You know, we make the plan and it's so perfect, but actually often never is when it gets delivered. And then when you're reflecting on it, you're saying, oh yeah, that session was good or bad. But actually my question I was going to ask you was that when you're reflecting on that whether that session was good or bad, it's also looking at it through the lens of your own bias. Mm-hmm. Because you've got an expectation, you've got a plan of what this should have looked like or could have looked like. And if it doesn't fit that mold, you then reflect on it and critique it based on that bias of your plan, rather than actually sometimes being able to take a step back. And this is probably where the benefit of having a second coach working alongside you or someone else working alongside you might benefit you in that. Actually, I think it was a really bad session because I knew what I was going after. But you might have seen some really good positives in that. But has that ever happened to you?
I would say no, but the only reason I'd say no is because I'm like hypercritical when it comes to if I think something didn't work well, there's no amount of convincing that will make me think that it went well. So even on like my Cambridge interview, I thought it was an awful session, but they were like, we saw your potential in terms of communication skills, in terms of the things that I wanted to deliver didn't work well. But then within a minute, I jumped in and adapted them. So it's not necessarily everything always has to work perfectly, but people want to see promise and signs of, you know, you recognizing your faults in real time and making adjustments. There's two things I want to touch on as well that you said earlier. So the first thing is, you know, when it comes to holding yourself accountable, we're often always telling players to have that mindset and that if they want to be a professional footballer, they have to hold themselves accountable and just work the extra, you know, work extra hard or run the extra mile. So we can't instill that mindset in them if we're not doing it ourselves. That's the first thing. And then secondly, in terms of like session planning and checking outcomes, I feel like when you're a younger coach, especially, you feel like you have to have the whole session in your head and get every single coaching point out, every single outcome out, and it has to flow naturally. Whenever I look at top level coaches online or in under 21s or whatever level, first team, they're always holding pieces of paper. So one thing I've tried to do is just print my plan out and hold it with me. Because it's impossible, and it's human nature for you to forget things. It's impossible for you to take every single outcome that you've planned, especially in terms of individual interventions from your head. I feel I don't think there's any harm in holding the plan if you forget something and check not the whole session or the whole design of a practice, but if you forget an individual intervention or a specific time that you want to work with an individual, I don't think there's any harm in checking that.
Do you know, I completely get what you mean by that. I think I'm just going to share another perspective on it. One, I think if you really understand your players and you know your players, and I get the point that you're making about having it there almost as a prompt and a reminder around the things that you want to cover, because either A, there might be so many things that you're trying to get through, which again is probably going to be your first your first hurdle, because you've probably got too much that you're trying to go after if you're going to have to keep a note of it. But second, again, I'm just playing devil's advocate. If you're having to keep a prompt to remind you about an intervention, could it suggest you don't know enough about that player? But also that you're planning your interventions before they've happened.
That's a very good point. I wouldn't necessarily say it's got to be almost robotic. So it's like, okay, it says open body shape when receiving on here, so I have to do it. But you might have, for example, you might plan a specific style of intervention to go over a specific practice, but then you might have tendencies to completely different way. So I feel like if you don't necessarily have that prompt at certain points, you might go command within that practice, whereas this might flow better or serve the players better with guided discovery. The thing is, I don't necessarily ever hold my plans, especially when it comes to like senior people watching me or interviews, because I feel like it gives off a vibe of not knowing what you're delivering. However, it's something I've tried to do more and more. And I feel like when I do it, I do tick more boxes or check more objectives, I feel personally.
But is that because you're giving yourself more boxes to tick in the first place?
I wouldn't necessarily say so, because I generally, if I'm like,
again, I'm not saying it is the case, I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, no, of course. I would generally give, so like whole group interventions, 1 to 3 max. But let's say I want to work with ILP players, for example. It's very difficult when you're juggling multiple jobs and multiple things to have your whole session plan that you know off the top of your head, and it gets delivered perfectly the way you've designed it, to get all of your actual whole group interventions out and then get your ILP interventions out as well. And that's where I feel like it can be valuable.
Just on that though, so to pause you, but if you have got a session plan, and I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever delivered a single session where it's gone completely to plan.
Oh, no, never. Not at all.
So then, are we doing a disservice to ourselves by even suggesting we can make it?
I don't think it's realistic to deliver something perfect that's on paper. The only reason why I feel, especially like in terms of preaching it for younger coaches, is it gives you an opportunity to actively reflect in real time. So you go, this is what I intended to deliver. Does what I'm delivering on pitch look anything like this? And if so, how can I either regress it or progress it to make it more realistic to what I actually wanted to intend?
Yeah. And I'm completely with you. Again, I'm going to carry on this route of devil's advocate because I think there's so much to probe on here, right? My first perception of hearing that goes to, well, if you need the plan to figure out all the above, do you really know enough about it?
The thing is, and you'll know as well, it's just a sense you get when you're on the pitch. So if something's not going to plan, you can just sniff it out. And I feel like if you're experienced enough, you can just go, and you know.
But shouldn't that be the case regardless? So I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that as a coach, whether experienced, inexperienced, or whatever, just forget about, even about away from coaching. You can take your teaching role as an example. You can't teach something you don't know.
True.
And if you don't know it, you won't see it. So I completely get the rationale behind why someone may have that piece of paper or some notes there. I'm not discrediting that. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with it. But I think going back to one of the things you talked about there, perception, senior leadership, how is it viewed? Well, actually, he might not really know what he's doing unless he refers to that plan. I'm not saying that's the case, by the way. But there is a school of thought that may view it that way.
Definitely taboo. It's definitely taboo, especially in the academy sphere, 100%.
100%. But then I think, whether rightly, wrongly, or whether I agree with it, we'll park that for a second. But then look at it from the other perspective and say, actually, if you have to think about something, do you really know it? And what I mean by that is, like, if I ask you right now, what's your name? You're going to tell me Ruben, hopefully. Yeah. But it's because you know it, like, that's it. That's a fact. I know that for a fact. I'm not questioning my knowledge in it. I don't have to have a piece of paper that tells me that, right? But going back to my earlier point, if you have a plan, and I'm not saying you shouldn't plan your interventions, because I definitely think you should, not in terms of timing, but just having consideration in the planning of your interventions around what type of questions you might ask or whatnot. But ultimately, let's say you're one of the players in my group. if I'm intending on intervening with you today around your individual development plan, I think it sends off the wrong message for players, even if I'm having to review that plan just to remind me of what your individual development plan is, because I should know that, because that's something that I've identified within you. That's why it's part of your progression plan, right? I shouldn't need a piece of paper to remind me of that if I really know my players. So therefore, I'm not, and again, just playing devil's advocate, I'm not planning my intervention around you, because I already know what I'm going to intervene on, because I already know what you need to work on. I already know what support you need. But it also means that I'm open enough, and maybe this comes with experience and time, probably, but it also means I'm open enough and flexible enough to respond to the situation in a way where, actually, Ruben's killing it on this thing today, but I've seen something else that you might need support with right now, so let me go and address that. Because I think, ultimately, we're trying to help the players become better. Whether we do that or not as coaches, I don't really know. And it's a question I've started exploring. Do we actually make a difference? Or are we just stealing a living, right, as coaches? Again, a provocative one, but just something to think about in terms of, yeah, do I really need to be told? Do I really need to have a prompt? Now, what I might do, and this is where I do think notes and whatnot might come in, and it'll be interesting to get your thoughts, is maybe not on the intervention, but actually, what might be the questions I want to ask? Because I might plan my questions, not because I'm planning it for a certain time or a certain moment for it to take place. Because ultimately, and this goes back to full circle to like earlier on in the conversation, we're talking about the practice spectrum. You talk about you don't really spend too much time in the unopposed. You move it to kind of semi-opposed and move it then towards your function piece and make it opposed and whatnot. So they can practice what they were doing unopposed in that opposed scenario. But if I link it even back to that, does that even happen? Because the moment I step in front of you, your technique's going to change anyway. And I'm not discrediting the value of what unopposed practice can do. Although personally, I do believe it probably holds the least amount of value in terms of impact for the players within the context of certainly an academy session, but also certainly in a session where it's a group of players. I think I do take on board your point around, actually, could this be something that you do at the park with your mates or down at the Power League or with your dad on, you know, if you're in a position to be able to get access to any of the above. But ultimately, my viewpoint has always been, well, why would I get my players to do something with me that I can give them to do something elsewhere? Let them do the things with me that they can't do elsewhere, i.e. necessarily get a group of players together who will play a part of the same team and will train together. Why would I isolate them within that moment? But also there's pros and cons to it, and there's obviously different, you know, I guess, aspects to it. But full circle back to that and obviously linking it back to the points, I might then think about the points I'm going to give the players in round, right? I might ask you this question or I might ask Ruben that question rather than, right, I'm going to intervene on this. I know Ruben, or this says Ruben needs XYZ. Okay, so I'm going to keep an eye out for Ruben's XYZ. I don't know what your thoughts on it. It's a bit of a ramble, but there's a few different directions it's gone in there.
It's definitely taboo. And it's not something I actively do every session, but I find when I do it, I feel like I am being more intentional personally. And that's one thing I've had to learn over time, especially when, you know, you're by yourself as a cat-free coach, for example, and you've got five or six ILPs you're trying to work with, multiple coaching points you're trying to work with that apply to the whole group. It's not effective or reasonable, I feel, for you to tick every single box, no matter how in advance you plan. It's just human nature. You get into the games, you get into your coaching, time passes. So I don't think there's a problem with it, but I feel like, yeah, like you said, in terms of planning questions or planning intervention styles, that's how we can use it to be more intentional and help the players learn better, rather than saying, this is Micah's ILP, or receive on the inside of your back foot. Because I do agree, your whole group coaching points and your ILPs are things that you should know like the back of your hand. They should be things that are constant. Definitely agree in terms of unopposed practices. So like anything small-sided, if it's like early crosses, like crossing techniques, passing techniques, receiving techniques, these are things you can do at home for me, for example. you don't even need access to a defender or other players. You can literally have a bag of balls. You could use the tree as the defender. Can you whip one with your instep in behind the tree to dad, practicing your early crosses in the park by yourself? So those plus ones are massive. And I do think for younger players, those unopposed technical things are more important. But again, for me, high challenge, opportunities to see realistic pictures, because on a match day, you're very rarely going to be unopposed. Everyone says 1v1 this, 1v1 that. Most instances in football aren't 1v1s. They're 1v1s for like half a second and then they quickly become 2v1s. So that high challenge for me is massively important.
I think it's such a great point. You got me thinking on that last point about, you know, 1v1s and 2v1s. And I say to coach all the time, well, when does it become a 1v1 and when does it become a 2v1? What distinguishes that? Mainly because I like to probe and provoke thought. Also try and, again, not being intentionally difficult, but just really get coaches thinking like, wow, oh yeah, it's true. Why have I decided this is a 1v1 or that isn't? Because 9 times out of 10, when I say to coaches, go on, you know, how would you coach a 1v1? It's often some version of like a small box with two players on either end of it. When does it ever look like that? I'm not saying it doesn't, by the way, but how often does it look like that is probably the better question to ask. Like, and that 1v1 is also not the same 1v1 that they might be facing in the middle of the pitch or in the wings of the pitch or in different formats of the game. So why is that the only 1v1 we're working on? And if we're saying that that's the only 1v1 we're working on, then are we saying that we should just scrap positions and just put everyone facing each other on the pitch? Like, I don't know. So I guess, you know, just linked to that, you know, what are your views in terms of especially a foundation phase? And I'd be interested to kind of reflecting back on your experiences at Cambridge as well, working in the YDP. At foundation, what are some of the key things that you think players really need to be focusing on? Obviously, you're working with under-10s. And I always say that I think it's a really good and a good best practice to kind of have a good idea of what they were doing before they got to the age group you're in and what they should be doing by the time they get to the age group after the one you're in. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts in terms of maybe what a player should be able to do or you know, the things that coaches should be working on with players at under-10s in particular? And how does that contrast to what you had experienced as a coach working with 13s and 14s at Cambridge?
For me, passing and receiving is massive because it's the most frequent action in football. And it's weird because some of the under-10s can pass and receive better than the under-14s, but not with the same level of consistency. So it's different challenges that you're trying to manage. They can do it twice out of 10 times or three or four times out of 10 times with real consistency and quality. Let's say you're looking for like a grass cutter, a low driven one with your laces that stays along the floor. An under 14 will do that 7 times out of 10 because they understand the technique and the biomechanics behind it. Whereas an under 10, they can do it. But a lot of the time, if you ask them, they might not be able to replicate it consistently because they don't even understand how they've done it. They've just pulled it off because they're good players. So passing and receiving for me is the biggest thing. I would say finishing is massive in every single age group, like unopposed finishing off like cutbacks and sweaty goals. Like the amount of times people miss hit or hit the ball over the ball, don't even hit the target in those situations is massive in academy football. So given like a variety of opportunities and finishing scenarios in and around the box, I think is massively important. And then I know I said I don't really believe in 1v1s, but the ability to beat a player. So whether that's, you know, a centre-back receives, beats the press by driving forward and then has pressure from another midfielder into a 2v1, brilliant. Or let's say you play to your winger, they're facing up a defender who's trying to delay and then you've got a recovering winger from the opposite team. For me, those are brilliant. But those initial 1v1 situations, giving players opportunities to dominate their direct opponent is massive. And for me, they're always position specific. Like you said, I hate the whole put them in a box because that's not realistic to the game. It's multi-directional. You're never really going to get a midfielder that's going to pull off some of the actions that you see in those 1v1 kind of boxes. So it's got to be position specific and it's got to be relevant to, like I said, a picture.
I think you're spot on. I think definitely, you know, making it position specific and relevant to the picture. And I think as soon as you start looking at it through a position specific lens, you start to see different 1v1s emerge within that. And I guess even taking it a step back in terms of, you mentioned there about the under-10s being able to do it, but not really probably understand it biomechanically. Do you think enough coaches understand it biomechanically?
No. And that is a massive, like, grey area in and of itself, especially for coaches that haven't played football. So, like, I've played football, but never to a high level. And I've never really played, like, senior football. I've played, like, 4 games of, like, Step 7. So I've never really played to a high degree. But for me, if I'm watching football, I watch the way players open their body up and twist their hips. I watch the way they strike the ball or curve their run to get around it. And I feel like I probe quite a lot when it comes to the actual biomechanical patterns of striking a ball and movement. I think that links into my degree that I'd done, like, from 2019 to 2022. So I'd done a degree in football science at the University of Bedfordshire. And one of my courses was biomechanics. And it kind of opened up my mind to how you can incorporate biomechanics into making players better, because a lot of it isn't just they're good at doing it. There's actual specific techniques and movements that enable players to do certain things with consistency. So, for example, let's say you're whipping in an early cross of your instep. The way you twist your hips, the part of the foot you hit the ball with, these things matter. The way your shoulders are facing, these things matter. So highlighting and spotlighting that is massively important if you want players to actually understand and get better at their techniques.
I think you're spot on, and I completely agree with you in the value that obviously understanding that piece has. But I think for me, regrettably, it's probably one of the massive bits which I think has kind of slowly fallen away from coach development and coach education. And I'm not going to say necessarily for, well, tempted not to say it, but I think it probably is, on the whole, considered to be for good reason. Because ultimately, even if you look at the biomechanic piece that you're just talking about there, it's could that in turn lead us to becoming too prescriptive of how things should be done? But then that's part of the problem, isn't it? Because actually, it just doesn't work like that. However, through my own experiences, I've arrived at a point where actually, yes, biomechanically, there is some things that need to take place, but actually there's some things that, even away from the biomechanics, just the physics of the situation that we're in, have to remain objective regardless of the players that can, I guess, doing it. And it goes back to your point about watching and observing the, I guess, the under-10s and them being able to do certain things that maybe they can't recreate on tap, but they can do it. It's just not conscious, right? So it's unconsciously being able to do it. And I think, you know, the challenge that then puts in front of some coaches in recognizing, oh, actually, Ruben's just done this. I can see Ruben can do it. Yeah, but Ruben doesn't know how to do it. He's done it. He can do it, but he doesn't know how to do it. And coaches failing to observe and identify that actually Ruben doesn't know how to do it, although he has demonstrated he can do it and has done it before. And I think that's probably where a big gap is in for coaches and their observations and their potential and ability to have impact, because the perception could then be, well, I've seen Ruben do it, I don't need to address it. Actually, does Ruben really understand it? Because if he doesn't, you're still going to have to address it. Or more specifically, it brings me to a point which I talk about coaching a lot, is that we have this perception, especially when we come into the profession of coaching, that coaching is about correction. But I say, actually, no, coaching is about correction as well as reinforcement and praise, because there is things players are doing well that they don't even know they're doing well. And that's probably just as impactful, if not more powerful, to highlight for players than the things that maybe they need to develop or change or adapt to get better. So, like, it could have been, right, Ruben, I've just seen you play that pass. I love the way that you did X, Y, Z. And I talk about having a feedback framework, right? And the feedback framework is around, right, identify what you saw, recognize how it was done, and the impact it then had. So, for instance, Ruben, I love the way that you received the ball there. So already your attention has gone to how you received the ball, or the fact that you received the ball. I really like the way that you opened your left foot up, because it allowed you to X. Now, that packaged 3-step framework, all of a sudden you're thinking, right, okay, cool. So I received the ball, and as I did it, I used my left foot like this, and my left foot then, because of the way I did it, allowed me to achieve this. So as an example, Ruben, I love the way you received that ball there, where you opened up your left foot, it allowed you to then have a second touch into the passing opportunity for the player that you passed it to. You frame the whole situation for the player, and now it's, okay, cool. And then I always go back to the idea that whatever gets praised is encouraged. whatever gets recognized gets repeated because it wants to be rewarded again, right? And I think if we can catch players in those moments, but coming back to your point about the biomechanics, if coaches aren't in tune with that, and I'm sure there would have been some elements of that that you've even been observant to, whether by the coaches that you work with, whether it's possibly being on the B license that you was on, that maybe some details were brought up in that context, possibly. What would your advice be to coaches who are thinking, wow, what the hell are these guys talking about?
Two things. So just to touch on what you said in terms of like that feedback loop, one thing I've tried to, like, that's something I've tried to incorporate with the players. And one thing I think is massively transformational is like asking open-ended questions. So I'll just say to them, why was that so good? And it comes back to what I said earlier about them knowing more than you think they know. So a lot of the time, if you just ask an open-ended question, why was that so good? They'll be able to tell you specifically why. And then, like you said, it creates that hunger for repetition and then wanting to impress you and do it again because you've recognized it. In terms of like getting details wrong, I think you just need to coach, because too many people nowadays, I go on away games and to matches and sometimes watch other coaches coach, and too many people nowadays follow the whole FA way, which I think is essentially just being a mannequin and letting the game be the teacher. But actually, try and coach. If you get it wrong, it's all your own learning and you'll develop from it.
Just going to pick on that then. What is coaching to you? Because it's a conversation I have with a lot of people right now. I mean, I deliver courses, I deliver workshops, I teach on degrees. And the conversation I'm constantly having with coaches is putting on practice is not coaching.
Mm-hmm.
What's your perception of coaching?
For me, it's breaking down concepts in order for players to truly understand them. And those concepts have to be transferable to a match day, because that's what the players are going to play on the weekend. And that's the most important thing, in my opinion, in terms of an EFL academy and development.
How does one measure that? So if me and you are standing right now, we're watching someone do a session and claiming to have been coaching that session, what would be expecting to see from your perspective?
So for me, the debrief at the end, you always have to have a debrief at the end. Check the players' understanding. You can give them open or closed-ended questions, but for me, open-ended questions work slightly better, because then you get you get to truly, you know, appreciate if the players understand what you're talking about. And within that debrief, if they're getting that information, it's important. And then, like I said, my metric for judging success on a match day is if they can assimilate what we've worked on in training and the match day. So I don't really care about the scoreline as per se in terms of, you know, the EFL games program. Yes, we want to win games and we want to be competitive. But the most important thing is, are you actually learning what I'm teaching you? Because if you're not, there's a big divide. So checking in that understanding by being intentional with your match day objectives and being intentional with your debriefs at the end of sessions are massively important, in my opinion.
You've frazzled my brain a little bit because all the senses are going off and saying, right, I've got to ask this. But I'm going to touch on one thing really quickly and then I'll delve deeper into what you said. Would you mind sharing an example of what an effective match day target might be for you? Because I think this is a common thing for coaches. They always talk about having targets, always talking about, you know, making it specific and making it detailed. But what does that look like? Because I'll be coaches listening to this thinking, yeah, I do that really well.
So I'll give you two examples. One would be applicable to like a YDP, one would be applicable to like a FP. So our most recent session at Watford, we looked at crossing in and around the box. So it could be one of our in possession focuses, like I said earlier, would be creating a variety of crosses in and around the box. And then within that, check and challenge the boys' information. What are the three or four crosses that we've worked on throughout the week? So it could be lofted crosses down the byline, flashing it across like the 6-yard box, low and hard, cutbacks, and then early crosses in behind. And then if they can, you know, you might then have that kind of lens on, and you might be looking for that on the match day. So you might go, first two periods, I'm going to look for those crossing outcomes. And you might see more than you expect it to, because you actually are highlighting it and you're focusing on it. And again, if they can assimilate what they've worked on in training, that's meaningful for me. And then in terms of a YDP, for example, it would be a bit more, I would still give team objectives, but I would look more at unit objectives. So for example, if I'm playing with a front three and a 10 in behind, it could be, can we play into our 9 for then our 10 to be able to receive setback passes to then travel, or can our 9 pin the defender for the 10 to then take the ball over? And then for success for the wingers might look like how they then are able to appreciate the pass into the striker. So I'd maybe give more objectives, but more unit-based objectives for a YDP.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because it's something that I've reflected on a lot in my coaching journey and think, actually, how effective are match day targets if they're outcome-based and not performance-based? Because actually, if they're process goals rather than outcome goals, then I think there's probably something more tangible there. Because they might get the outcome that we're intending, but actually might be at the wrong times. Is that as impactful as them being able to recognize the right times to do things or try things at the times that they feel is the right thing? If we're trying to build autonomy and ownership for the players, and then I guess one of the other things it kind of brings up to me is to think about is that actually how effective are we as coaches? Coming back to one of your early points. You mentioned about reviewing the sessions and doing a debrief. I actually don't agree with debriefs. And a reason why, and I completely understand the logic in having them, because I actually think the rationale behind a debrief effectively is to, like you said, check understanding. But if I've had to wait to the end of the session to check their understanding, then what the hell have I been doing the whole session? Right? That should be, for me, a constant monologue. Constant dialogue throughout the session. This is what's happening. I can see this. I can see that. I can see that. And, you know, again, even when it comes to asking questions, I'm not really sure how important it is for players to be able to articulate what they've done in the session rather than the question that I actually ask a lot of players now is, what have they found useful in today's session? If I'm going to do a debrief, what have they found useful in today's session? Whereas I think a lot of coaches, in my opinion, in my experience, fall into the trap of trying to ask questions which will either affirm or confirm that they've achieved their plan. Which, again, not to be difficult or not to be malicious in the review of it, but it's almost like, well, what's the point in asking those questions? Why are you asking whether your plan went ahead? You should be able to tell you that regardless of what the players say. But then it's almost that ego piece that it has to hear the players say, yeah, Ruben, I learned what you said we learned. Do you know what I mean? But actually, that's never really the case. And I think the beauty of it, and this gave go back to the piece when I was, like I said, the acceleration of my development in that period of time, the question I would commonly ask is, like, you know, what have you taken away? Because what it really helped me do was, through observation, we're seeing whether the session is going to plan or not, right? Through reflection, we're able to identify and recognize where it could have been developed, where it has gone really well. But the bit that we don't get exposure to unless we ask the right questions is, yeah, but did it land with the players? If it did, great. But even then, what landed with the players is what I'm really wanting to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's just say, as an example, I've got three key things I'm going after today. All three of those things might have landed perfectly with you. But then there was also a fourth and a fifth thing that landed with you that I didn't even intend for. I want to know that.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to know, what did I do that helped you get those extra two things? Or rather, what didn't I do which helped you get those two extra things but didn't get the things I was going after? Right? And then it kind of, you know, it left me in a situation where I just became more conscious and intentional with, right, okay, what am I saying? How am I saying it? What practices am I putting on? What are the perceptions and what are the, observations for the players in terms of this practice and this point I've made? Because I might be saying one thing in this way, trying to get outcome A, but actually you've picked A and B from it. But then over there, he's perceived C from it. And he's perceived D from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, bloody hell, all I said was one thing, but you've all taken it from four different perspectives. Cool. What was it about that thing? So I'm more curious in terms of in a debrief, if I'm going to debrief one, is, right, at what point did I do anything in this session which caused you to think? Why did that make you think? What did it make you think about? I'm kind of, again, going back to your piece around open-ended questions, but rather than looking for things to confirm and clarify my plan, it really is to check the understanding, and not for them, but for me, because they know what they've taken away. But I think sometimes being able to hear what they've actually taken away from it gives me the power I need and the knowledge and the insight I need to develop it, reinforce it, and make it even better in the future. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I agree with you that you should actively be checking whether players understand them. Like I said, I think it's just that sense you get when you coach, you know if it's working, if players are taking things or if they're not. I would say it's more to confirm what we've been working on and confirm the why, because a lot of people just coach and say, yeah, this is what we're doing, but I want the players to understand the why. So in my like perception of a debrief, they're confirming the why behind what they're doing. But I think it's...
Isn't it too late though?
I wouldn't say so, because like I said, I think you're actively measuring that as things are going on. You can actively probe and ask individual questions and interventions as things go on to know, and you do know. But I think what you said is quite interesting in terms of actually opening it up, especially if you're like a constraints-based coach, because then you're learning about the unintended outcomes, like you said, of what's come out, and you're progressing in the process. And it's not just, you know, a tick box for your ego. It's kind of you're growing as well through active feedback. So I feel like that's something that I would consider doing in my own environment 100%. But yeah, in terms of my thought process behind a debrief, it wouldn't be, okay, have you finally learned something after an hour? It's why have you learned what you've learned, and how is it relevant and applicable to a match day?
But should you not want to know that at the beginning?
100%.
So as an example, if I pitch the session to you, right, the first thing I'm saying is, right, Ruben, here's what we're going to work on today. And then I'll ask you, is any question? You might say, yeah, why are we doing that? Right, brilliant. Bang, straight from the get-go, within the first 2 minutes, I'm telling you what we're doing, why we're doing it, and now we're going to go and do it, right? And the reason behind that is because I just take it in any other walk of life. And maybe just because of the personality that I've got, you ain't going to get me to do something I can't see the relevance in.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? So there's no point you trying to get me to understand the relevance 60 minutes after you've been trying to get me to do it. Tell me why I'm doing it, and then I'll understand it. Because again, if I don't see the relevance in it, I'm probably not going to do it. Whereas actually, the relevance is what I need to get my buy-in. So why would, and again, I'm not saying you're wrong, by the way, if that's how you approach things. I'm just saying, I think we're missing a trick as coaches by leaving the goodies to the end.
I think you do have to, like you said, introduce it in the beginning though as well. Like, so it's not just, this is what we've done for the last hour, this is the session, bingo, bango. The first thing I say is, if the boys are in a group, firstly, how was your day at school? What did you learn at school today? Dennis, this is what we're working on. This is why we're working on it. In terms of confirming it, you are right in the sense that it probably is ego-based and you want to feel like you've had, you know, impact on the players and you're like, okay, they took this coaching point away, this coaching point away. But I think it's, like you said, it's something that actively has to happen throughout the whole session from beginning, middle and end. It's not just leave it to the end and this is what we've done. It's actively going on.
I agree. I'm just playing devil's advocate, man. Just putting some thoughts out there, see what bounces back. Because at the end of the day, like, it's just the same way as it is for players when we're delivering sessions. You know, this conversation is about learning and development. And hopefully anyone listening to this will be having some thoughts around it as well. So I guess my question to you, because I'm conscious of time as well, what's prompted your thinking the most in this conversation?
That's a very good question. I would say what you said most recently in terms of the way you frame your debrief in terms of checking unintended outcomes, because that's something I've not even necessarily ever considered. And I feel like as a coach, when you plan, you kind of have an understanding of the unintended outcomes and the trade-offs when you design a session, but you never really get to hear it from the player's perspective. And that can be valuable because you might be working on finishing the attack, for example, and working on the wingers and the striker to make runs into the box. But there could be really good opportunities for the midfielders to use the disguise to play in behind. And if you're not actually checking that and reaffirming that in the player's head that those are good things that they're picking up on, then they might not do that the next time. So I feel like that's something I might take away and try actively action in my own environment.
I'm curious to know for my own self now, is there anything that you've heard me say or share or bounce back on where you think, nah, you're bonkers?
All of it. Yeah, so all of it.
No, I think it's a good conversation, right? And I think, you know, yeah, it's 100%. Important. Us just got, like, we're only going to develop if we have this conversation. So we're being honestly and truly reflective on it, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, I'm curious. Is there anything that you think, oh, actually, I'd really push back on that?
No, I think it's all been good. And like I said, I think these difficult conversations are important because I might go away from that and go, "Oh, what did you just say?" And actually, that might then, set a spark and change the way I do things. And likewise, you might go, "Actually, I do really like a debrief now." So you never know. Like, I think these difficult conversations are important because they help us grow as people. And at the end of the day, if you're not willing to have them, you're gonna reach a plateau and then stop developing at the end of the day. And being receptive as well to other people's input is massive, especially people that are more experienced than you. If you was not willing to take people's advice, you're bonkers, I feel. And all the best development and learning I've ever done is when I've taken stuff from other people or learned from other people, and that's the way it goes. So I think it's all been really good, to be fair.
Awesome, awesome. Final question for you, Rube. Been coaching for what, last since you were 16, you said. So how many years is that now?
Coming up to 10.
Right, so coming up to 10 years. So you've had a good little stint and you started early. Now there's many pros and cons to that, but I'm curious now, what's some of the biggest things that you've picked up along this journey that you wish you knew when you were 16 starting out?
Having an understanding of different ways to coach people is massive. So, like I've said, like throughout this conversation, understanding your auditory, kinesthetic, and visual learners and picking up on that early. So you give players the best chance of maximizing their own development whilst they're under your care. It's no good after 7 months going, "Oh, this kid's a visual learner," because he's already spent copious amounts of time not developing. I would say work at all levels of the game is massively important. So if you can coach babies, you can coach men. If you can coach men, you can coach academy kids. So being open-minded and working with every single age group you can. The only kind of population I haven't worked with is girls or women. And again, I still feel like if you work in the women's game, there's massive amounts of things that you can learn and take away from that as well. So working at all levels is massively important. And then another thing I think I wish I've done it throughout my life, but I wish I specialized and got into a school early because it's massively important in the way you communicate with people. And the thing is as well, it puts you in an environment where you appreciate soft skills because there might be times where your boss or people around you don't have those soft skills and it really winds you up. So then it can put you in a position that when you step into your, domain of football, you really take pride and value those soft skills because not everyone has it. And if you do have those soft skills, people will run for a wall for you. And just understanding human psyche and behavior is massively important. And working in a school, especially in an alternative provision where people are swearing at you all day long and trying to hit you and do all sorts, it really gives you like a newfound view on life.
Appreciation.
Yeah, appreciation for, being able to communicate effectively, managing your own emotions as well as managing other people's emotions and expectations. So I'd say, yeah, working in a school as well has been massively influential.
Yeah, no, I think there's some great points there, Ruben. I think the most prominent one is that final one that you said there, and it's really about those transferable skills. I mean, ultimately, and I see this not just in football, but just think just as a society, it's definitely shifted more towards the direction of. It's about building connections, recognizing people for who they are before they're players, before they're this, a teacher, before they're whatever else they are, right? That you've got to connect with the individuals, and ultimately it's the relationships which are going to get the buy-in. Like I say all the time, like if you know that I care about your development, your progress, and just about you as an individual, you're probably much more likely to be able to take on board anything I say, even if you don't like it. Because deep down, it's coming from a good place, and he's doing it with good intentions. So I think I just don't get it when I see coaches who disregard certain players. And again, just because it's me being provocative in terms of coach development and just challenging coaches' thinking, I always, why is it the player that's the problem or your ability to handle
Players aren't stupid. They
them?
know if you're passionate and you genuinely care. They're not stupid at any age group. They know.
It's not players, it's people, isn't it? And I think that's the key, right? It's like you can tell when someone's trying to put on an act, or whenever someone's not being genuine, and it's like it comes through so quickly. So it's like if you're gonna do this, do it because for the right reasons. And I think the final thing I'd say on that is that ultimately it's about developing people. We happen to have done it. We do that through, from in my case through coaching and coach development. In your case, through teaching and coaching yourself. And I think the important part is that we're there to try and have an impact and a positive one with people that we work with. But it's got to start with the relationships that we build with them, rather than us deciding what the outcome should be for them. But now, Ruben, it's been a real pleasure to kind of connect with you tonight, man. Really understand a little bit more about your journey and your thoughts on debriefs in particular. I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you very much.
No, yes, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it, mate.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.